from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Carlson. Coming up, NPR News reporter Tamara Keith and her reporting assignments to Haiti and the Gulf oil spill. Plus, crime novelist Ridley Pearson and his latest novel, In Harm's Way, and musician Marianne Call. She's a classically trained singer who honed her style in Alaska coffee shops. First, we'll talk about top stories in local news and in sports with Sacramento Bee columnist Marcus Bertone. Marcus, welcome back.
Thank you.
There's been a lot of talk recently, including in your column, about the salaries that some city managers get paid in California, most notably the recent former city manager of the small city of Bell in Southern California. You wrote, there's a case to be made that in Sacramento, the people are getting their money's worth. Why do you think Gus Vina is fairly paid?
Fairly being a subjective word, obviously, Jeffrey. Gus Vina is the... He should be pronouncing Gus Vina, actually, but whatever.
There's no tilde on the end, though.
There should be, but okay, that's fine. But he is the interim city manager in Sacramento. He took over when Ray Carriage went up to Roseville. Ray Carriage making more money up in Roseville, smaller city, just a fraction of the issues that that they have to deal with, that we actually have poor people here in Sacramento that they have to deal with. And so the fact that several suburban city managers are making more, the fact that there's no one doing this job that has to deal with the poverty, with the political intrigue, with the union muscle, that in this case, and the fact that, you know, the guy's basically on a seventh-month contract, and then in March they'll figure out whether they want to keep him or not, that... By and large, Sacramento right now is getting its money's worth from this guy, particularly having to deal with this ridiculous city council that's in place right now in Sacramento, where even consent items are hotly debated. It's a job that, look, I mean, he wanted it and he wants it. He wants to continue in that job. But with all the discussion about what city managers make, the fact that the one in the largest city in the region is making less than several of his counterparts and has to deal with far more. I think a case can be made that he's making his money. We are getting our money's worth.
Yeah, in our region, the city managers that make more money than Gus Vina or Gus Vina are Roseville, Rockland, Rancho Cordova, and Citrus Heights. At the end of your column, though, you quote Gus Vina as saying, "Those of us who go into this line of work don't do it for the money." Which might be true in some cases, but when you're making $215,000, that's easy to say.
It is, but it's a lot of money. He's an executive. He oversees 4,800 employees, including the Sacramento Police Department and Sacramento Fire Department. So, and he also has to be the representative dealing with very powerful development interests who are trying to do works in Sacramento. How much is that worth? Do you want the person who's overseeing police and fire and dealing with very powerful interests to be making $80,000 a year?
Yeah.
$75,000? I mean, I don't know. We're all fired up right now about what some of these bean counters make, but it's an interesting question.
We like to deal with breaking news and insight when we can, and I just read that Mexicana Airlines, or maybe Mexicana, I should say, has suspended operations at Sacramento International Airport. And if I'm not mistaken, that means the airport will revert to its former dreaded status of a quote-unquote international airport without actual international flights.
Yes, that's sad. You know, obviously, it's a financial decision. The ripples of the economic turndown are felt in so many different ways, and I actually never avail myself of flying directly from Mexico from Sacramento to Mexico, so I guess I'm partly responsible for this decision. It's too bad, and hopefully when the economy gets better, we'll get some more flights to Mexico.
My guest is Marcus Bertone, Sacramento Bee columnist. His columns appear each Wednesday and Sunday in the papers, our region section. He's usually on Insight the first Wednesday of each month, but not this month, as the astute members of our audience will have noticed. Also in today's paper, there's a story about Kevin Johnson, the mayor of Sacramento, saying that he's going to resume his push for a homeless campground, which I guess means he's coming back around to this never-ending issue to find a place where the homeless can legally camp.
Right.
Do you think he's going to get his way on this one?
No. No. Because he's the lone person on the city council who is pushing this idea. The staff, city manager, Gus Vigna, the staff, none of the city council people think that it's a good idea. It's not a good idea to have a homeless camp in an urban setting. And the cities where it's been tried, despite the fact that homeless advocates will say it's not working. What they end up doing is attracting more homeless people. They end up becoming health hazards. It's just a bad idea. It's an idea that the mayor just is fixated on since this phony report that was on the Oprah Winfrey Show a year or so ago that just generated all this interest in homeless issues. And in his mind, I believe he wants to solve it so that Oprah can come back at some point somehow. When he doesn't realize that, you know, once the homeless camp was gone, the TV cameras didn't care anymore. It's just a bad idea all the way around, and he's the only person on the council who wants it.
Something where he definitely did not get his way was a strong mayor issue, and it appears to be dead for now, although in Kevin Johnson's mind, it's kind of like Frankenstein. You keep shooting bullets in him, and he keeps walking. But if he doesn't get his way before the next election, should we assume that Kevin Johnson would actually want to run for re-election?
It's a good question, Jeffrey. He and I don't really have a relationship, so it's hard for me to speculate. I don't think anybody really knows right now what he will do, given that he won't have enhanced powers as a mayor to run for re-election. We're 2 years away from, so he basically has 2 years to decide and actually to do something as the mayor of Sacramento. So it's going to be interesting to see. He couldn't have played the strong mayor thing any worse than he did. And it was clear that the votes weren't there. Forged ahead, lost a 7-2 vote, kept pushing it afterwards. And finally, he was sort of the last man to realize that it just had to be tabled for now.
Because he was quoted recently saying that he can't do the things that he campaigned on. But, of course, when he campaigned for mayor, those powers didn't exist.
Those powers didn't exist, and he didn't campaign on strong mayor. It was sort of under the radar, but it was not a key point. You know, he was talking about jobs and public safety. Those were the primary things that he was talking about. So to say now, well, I can't do what I want to do, well, dude, you didn't campaign on that. You know, so I think a lot of people, myself included, are fed up with the whole situation, with that posture. And you know, if you're not going to lead, then maybe somebody else should.
A story in the paper yesterday included the following sentence. It started talking about this woman from Los Angeles who's a Latina. Said the 47-year-old Los Angeles working mother belongs to an increasingly key California voter group, Latinos, who political consultants say are now too numerous for statewide candidates to antagonize or ignore. That might well be true, but I feel like I could have read that 20 years ago.
Yes, that's been, you know, we trot out those stories every 4 years, and there is increasing evidence that Latinos as a voter bloc are becoming more influential, but it does become slippery when you try to extrapolate the information in the sense that when you try to sort of call them, for years it was the sleeping giant, you know. And the fact of the matter is that the community is not a monolith. And there are opportunities, for example, for the Republican Party to make inroads because culturally, Latinos often, particularly on social issues, are conservative. Where it all breaks down for the GOP is on immigration and on the GOP's really unwillingness to realize that they have a gold mine here and not really trying to cultivate it. So, I can't think of a single GOP candidate who's Mexican-American, with the exception of the lieutenant governor. And it's the opportunities there to be had. It's just they haven't really done anything with it.
My guest is Marcus Bertone, Sacramento Bee columnist. A couple of days ago, a little bird told me that you were doing something with Ken Burns, a documentary filmmaker.
Yes.
What's going on?
I'm leaving tomorrow for the big TV critics meeting in Los Angeles. And Ken Burns has a film called 10th Inning, and it's the sequel to his epic baseball documentary that came out in 1994. And so this, the 10th inning, begins from 94 onward. A lot of things have happened since 94, steroids in baseball, the baseball strike. And 2 years ago, they reached out to me and flew me to New York, and we did an interview. And so imagine my surprise when 2 years later I get sent the rough cut. And for whatever reason, I'm all over it. We talked about Latinos in baseball, because I've written a couple of books about that. Barry Bonds plays a big role in this film, and I obviously covered him when he was at his best and at his worst, steroids. And so we talk about a whole range of issues, and it's a phenomenal film. And I'm not saying that because I'm in it, but it's typical Ken Burns quality. Mr. Burns obviously will be coming to Sacramento in mid-September for an event at Raley Field that we're holding, and so I'm pretty excited about it.
And does Ken Burns' camera linger longingly in a sepia-toned photograph of you?
Jeffrey, thankfully it's soft lens, and they lit me very well. So my response to you, Jeffrey, is my face is not the best selling point for anything, but it actually makes me look good. And so that's a great thing.
And finally, Marcus, you're not the only celebrity in the Bertone family. Last week, I gave what's called the curtain speech at a performance of Othello for the Sacramento Shakespeare Festival. And when I was backstage, I was introduced to a fellow who looks a lot like you and sounds a bit like you.
My brother Rodrigo, and that's actually a character in the play that.
But he played Iago.
He played Iago. He was in Othello. He played Iago, and there's a character named Rodrigo, which is my brother's name. I actually went to see the show closing night last night at Shakespeare in the Park in Sacramento. It's a beautiful tradition that we have here. And my brother, is a very successful local actor. So you can imagine me and my brother in the house. It was kind of loud growing up. You can imagine.
Marcus Bertone, Sacramento Bee columnist. His columns appear each Wednesday and Sunday in the paper's Our Region section. He's usually on Insight the first Wednesday of each month. Marcus, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, NPR news reporter Tamara Keith. That was great. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Did you disagree with something? Tell us what and why at insight@capradio.org. Today on Talk of the Nation, author and scholar Cornel West and his second thoughts about President Obama. Plus, Packing for Mars. It's a new book about the nitty-gritty of daily life in space. And a political science professor who's written a book that claims that colleges are, quote, wasting our money and failing our kids. That's Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. NPR reporter Tamara Keith has been around a lot this year, including assignments to Haiti and the Gulf oil spill. She'll speak about those experiences tonight in Sacramento, but she joins us first on Insight. Tamara Keith, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Well, let's start with your more recent of those two assignments, the Gulf oil spill. Where did you go?
Well, I've actually been down twice now, and I'm about to go back after this little vacation is over. I went first to Biloxi, Mississippi. There was a thought that the oil was headed in that direction. Ultimately, it didn't get there while I was there, and Mississippi has been impacted less by the oil and more by the fear of the oil. And then I spent a lot of time, almost 2 weeks, in New Orleans and around New Orleans, going all onto the different tentacles of Louisiana down into the Gulf area.
When you said that the people in Mississippi are affected more by the fear of the oil than the actual oil, what do you mean?
Well, Biloxi in particular is a tourism-based economy. They have the casinos, they have the white sand beaches. They have people who come down there to go fishing because there's great fishing and shrimping. And those types of things are affected by an oil spill, even if the oil isn't there. Much of the fishing was closed off. And You know, people don't want to plan a vacation down to an area where there might be globs of oil washing up on the beach, even if they plan to spend the whole day inside of a casino. It's just had a real effect.
And what about in New Orleans? You said you spent a couple of weeks in Louisiana. What did you find there? Was there more actual direct oil impact there as well as the fear of the oil?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's an interesting thing because this oil spill is so huge, but it's not everywhere. So there will be spots where it's horrible and disgusting and thick and looks like peanut butter. And then there are other areas where there's a sheen. And there are other areas where there's just a little bit of foamy stuff. Or I was out in some wetlands and the water looks fine, but all of the marsh grasses are just covered in oil and there's like there are birds and it's sad. And so it's really hard to get a sense of the scope because it is just so huge and it's so different. At some point, Thad Allen, the Coast Guard commander, said, this isn't an oil spill. This is thousands of tiny oil spills.
And what about the people themselves? How are the people of Louisiana doing? It seems like they can never catch a break. There's always something going on there, sometimes catastrophic, including this oil spill. How are they doing?
You know, I think a lot of people are having, I don't know if you'd call it flashbacks, probably not, but it's like Katrina all over again, they keep saying, except that it's different because it's uncertain. You know, at least with Katrina, they had this sense of, okay, this is a hurricane. This is a very, very bad hurricane, but we've been through this before. We know how to fix this. We'll just build again. With this, there's this sort of uncertain feeling of how long is it going to last? How long is oil going to keep washing up? How long are our oyster beds going to be destroyed? And folks don't know how to rebuild from that. And so I think it's having a real psychological impact. There's also a financial impact. I did a story about huge lines, people showing up at 4 and 5 in the morning to get a $100 gift card for food because not only is fishing their livelihood, but it's a source of subsistence.
My guest is NPR News reporter Tamara Keith. You said you're about to go back to the Gulf area quite soon. Given that the oil well appears to be blocked up now, or is in the process of being blocked up, and given that a lot of the surface oil has now gone, I just read that in a newspaper story mm-hmm. the other day, what is the story now?
That's a good question. I think it is that trying to find a path forward. A lot of the fishing areas are actually still shut down. And then there is the question of what are the long-term effects? And so I think that will be some of the story is people trying to get their bearings.
Where are you going to go? Louisiana again?
That's the plan, at least for now.
Tamara Keith of NPR. Her assignments this year have included Haiti and the Gulf oil spill. She speaks tonight at 6 at a Sacramento Press Club event. Well, let's talk about Haiti now. When did you go there? How long after the earthquake was it?
I got there, I think it was a week after the earthquake. It was a devastating situation. People were very raw. It was very familiar. It had just happened. The one thing that I feel, and this is weird to say, I feel lucky that I wasn't there immediately in the first couple of days, because by the time I got there, most of the bodies were gone. I saw very few dead bodies. And when I did, it was incredibly jarring. Whereas if I had been there a few days earlier, they would have been everywhere.
What was the mood like among the people? Did this strike you as being hopeful that they were going to pull through this, or was it a darker mood?
Well, Haiti is a place that has, even before the earthquake, Haiti had a lot of problems. And it also had a lot of hopeful people. It's a very, very religious country. I mean, you hear about voodoo, but that's more cultural than it is religious. I mean, everyone there, all of our local translators, all of the folks that you spoke with, they spoke about God, and you know, you would think in a situation like that, people would lose their faith, but they didn't. In fact, in many ways, their faith was renewed.
One of the stories that you filed when you were in Haiti was about the race to gather Haiti's lost children, because there were a lot of problems with children apparently being taken out of the country, and, you know, who knows what was happening. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, you know, I was inspired to do that story in part because there were all of these, as I was preparing to go to Haiti, stories about, we've got to save the Haitian orphans. And, you know, people posting on Facebook saying, I'll take one. And so I went over there wanting to find out what the real situation was. And it's much more complicated than you'd imagine. There are a lot of children in Haiti in orphanages, and their parents are still alive. But their parents were afraid that they couldn't care for them. They felt that they'd be better off in an orphanage where they'd get religious training and an education. So there were there are also children that are being given up forever, that their parents want their children to go to another country, to go to a better place. So it was a very complicated, nuanced situation where the term orphan, even in normal times, is complicated in Haiti. But then there were all of these children who were separated from their families as a result of the earthquake. A kid who ran out to get something from the store or to pick up something at the bank and comes home and his house has collapsed and he doesn't know where his parents are and he starts just running through the streets. I was actually able to go with a child who had been separated from his mother for 2 weeks as he was being reunited with his mother, which was an absolutely amazing thing to witness.
I can imagine. Probably the two biggest disaster stories in the world this year that I'm aware of have been the Haiti earthquake and the Gulf oil spill. How do the people who live in those areas treat the news media? Because I'm guessing there's just flocks of news media from all around the world descending in both these places. How do the people there respond to people like you?
So in Haiti, there was this feeling, and I've seen this in other disasters before, with the wildfires even in Southern California, where there was this feeling that the media, maybe the media could help. Like maybe if we could just get some attention to our tent camp here, maybe somebody would bring us water and food. And so the desperation to talk into that microphone was overwhelming. And there was this immense sense of responsibility that I felt that I couldn't live up to, that these people are talking to me because they think I can help them, and I don't know what I can do to help them except tell their story. In Louisiana and in Mississippi, yes, people wanted folks to know that they were angry and that they were being hurt and they didn't want to be forgotten, but it was worlds apart.
Finally, Tamara, another project that you've done over the years is something called B-Side Radio.
Yes.
And I was listening to one of those those old episodes today, and it was called Child Star. Because when you were a kid, you were something of a child star.
A little bit, in a
small way. You were in all these ads and TV and newspapers and magazines and so on. And your parents were in it. And I think it was your mother who said, we were living through you? What was it like to talk to your parents and hear them say that your success as a child star helped them, I guess, get over the feelings of regret over what they hadn't done?
Mm-hmm. You know, the funny thing is, I was just visiting my parents yesterday, and they had dragged out this huge box of newspaper clippings, and they were showing my husband and I all of the pictures. This was you in People magazine. See, you were the centerfold of People magazine, and Barbara Streisand was on the cover. So it continues. For me, it's wonderful to have parents who are so proud of you. And they're also total public radio junkies.
So the fact that you're now working for NPR.
Oh, they're thrilled. And
even better than People magazine.
Oh, even better. And I think, you know how grandparents will pull out pictures of their grandkids whenever given an opportunity? I'm pretty sure that my parents are like, oh, do you listen to NPR? Have you ever heard of a Tamara Keith? You know, my last name is Keith.
Oh, my goodness.
They're constantly telling me, I just spoke to someone who's a huge fan. And I'm pretty sure it's much like the people who are looking at the grandkids and say, oh, my gosh, they're so adorable.
Well, I don't know if your parents will be there, but anyone is welcome this evening at 6 o'clock at the Beehive, which is the Eleanor McClatchy Meeting Room opposite the Sacramento Bee and Q Street. It's a Sacramento Press Club event, and Tamara Keith will be speaking there. Tamara, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, crime novelist Ridley Pearson. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. I'm on Twitter. Follow me for info about Insight and tittle-tattle about public radio. Tomorrow, how Californians feel today about offshore oil drilling, plus White Heat, the provocatively themed new suspense romance novel from Brenda Novak, who's also a fundraiser extraordinaire for juvenile diabetes. The popular crime novelist Ridley Pearson is coming to town soon with his new book. The novel, In Harm's Way, is set in Idaho's wilderness, a place Pearson's explored many times both in person and in fiction. Ridley Pearson is also a former Fulbright Fellow in Detective Fiction at Oxford University and a founding member of the Rock Bottom Remainders, the rock and roll group made up of writers, also including Stephen King and Dave Barry. Ridley Pearson, welcome to Insight.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
What is it about Idaho's wilderness that appeals to you as both a person and a writer?
Well, you know, living here off and on now for nearly 30 years, it grows inside of you, and in these novels, it's become a major character. You know, we have heroes and villains and love interests, but there's no hero quite like the wilderness, nor is there a villain quite like the wilderness, and certainly it's everyone's love interest.
Yeah. For people who haven't been to Idaho, how would you describe the wild areas?
Where I live and write about is technically high desert. It's just the beginning of the alpine mountain region. The Sun Valley snow and ski resort is set here. And the small town of Ketchum, which began its life as a mining town going after silver and lead. And you can, within about 4 or 5 minutes of leaving Ketchum, you're in absolute wilderness and national forest that goes for thousands, if not millions, of acres around it. There's something like 6 mountain ranges that immediately connect to this Ketchum-Sun Valley area.
But you were born in New York State, weren't you?
Yes, and grew up in Connecticut, just outside of New York City. I migrated out here, I'm in Idaho now, in 1980, and then left to live full-time in St. Louis about 9 years ago.
My guest is Ridley Pearson. His latest novel is In Harm's Way. He'll be in Sacramento at the Borders next Monday evening. How did you become a writer? Was it an intention or was it an accident?
It was more of an accident. I think I've always been a storyteller. And I began telling my stories by trying to be James Taylor in the 70s. That didn't go so well. But I had a great time playing sort of folk rock and folk music with a number of different players. For about 11 years, I was out on the road and making basement albums and selling them literally out of the back of a 66-passenger school bus that we all traveled around in that could sleep 4 or 5 people. And, you know, that's its own life. I was making $50 a night and staying up till 3 in the morning, and it just didn't appeal to me. And in there somewhere, I started writing full-time during the day and playing music at night. That went on for 8 of those 11 years and finally sold, I think I wrote 11 screenplays and 3 novels before I sold anything. And, you know, I got about enough to buy a microwave oven and continued to try to write novels. And finally, my 4th novel surprised us all and became a big bestseller. And now I've gone on to write about 39 of them.
When you started writing novels, were they thrillers?
I started by writing more. The very first one I wrote was kind of a John D. McDonald takeoff, straight murder mystery, first person. It was just awful. And by the time I sold one, it was a multiple point of view, third person narrative about a guy trying to smuggle chemical weapons across Canada.
Oh,
it sold about 4 copies, I think.
My guest is Ridley Pearson, who sold a few more novels since those days. I noticed you said that when you started writing, you wrote about 11 screenplays and 3 novels, which suggests that you were, at that time, more interested in writing movies.
Yeah, I really was. I got into this. I thought that might be more of a commercial place. I just didn't think one could sell a novel. And I tried writing in those days Columbos and Quincy's. Both of them were sort of mystery television shows. I didn't sell any, but I was very fortunate to be mentored by a guy named Stan Silverman, who had been the head writer of an old show called Sea Hunt, Lloyd Bridges was in Sea Hunt back in the 60s. And Stan was just amazing to me. He you know, helped me with my rewrites. He lent me his agent. And again, we never sold any of these, but it was a terrific learning experience. It was like a very long 8 years of graduate school.
You said that you started out in life as an adult trying to be a professional musician, and in fact you were. And although you're now, your career is as a writer, you still play music. You're a member of, a founding member of the Rock Bottom Remainders, that sort of sprawling rock and roll group of writers, many of them quite famous, including Stephen King. What instrument do you play in the Rock Bottom Remainders?
I play the bass guitar. That's a terrific adjective, Jeffrey. The idea of it being sprawling is incredibly appropriate. It's Amy Tan. Now the cast, the nefarious cast, is Dave Barry, Amy Tan, Scott Turow, Mitch Albom, Greg Isles, Roy Blunt Jr., Matt Groening. You know, sometimes we're blessed with other people who come in and actually make us sound good, but despite 17 years of play, we've never gotten one bit better. We're still sort of the world's worst rock and roll band, but we do it for good causes.
Do you ever all play together at the same time?
Absolutely. Yeah, well, I mean, we try to hit the same notes at the same time, Jeffrey, but that doesn't always work out. But we're certainly on the same stage at the same time. We just in April, we did a four-city tour of Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, New York, and Boston. And we do this, just so your listeners know, too, because we are so pathetic, to raise money for good causes, mostly literary causes and literacy causes. And I think we've raised a little over $2.5 million in the 17 years.
Wow.
But it's sort of on the, it's almost on that idea of the guy who sits in the lawn chair over the tub of ice water at the county fair, and if you hit the target, he falls in. That's sort of the level of play. We're just up there making absolute fools of ourselves, but people pay good money to support causes and come see us.
How exactly did it get started? Do you know whose idea it was?
Yeah. In fact, not too far from you. It was when you go out on book tour, which I'm about to do tomorrow for In Harm's Way, you are traveled around each city by somebody who knows the city well enough to get you to the media spots like NPR, which are often more difficult to find than people would think, and that's called a media escort. And a media escort in San Francisco named Kathy Goldmark, you as the author, you sit in the front seat of this person's car about 12 hours a day, once a year, for year after year after year. And Kathy had gotten to know well many, many authors, including me. And one day I got a fax from her. And she said, hey, would you be willing to fly yourself down to a big book event in Los Angeles? It was actually in Anaheim, and play bass in a band. And I wrote back and said, of course, that sounds like a great cause. It was for First Amendment rights. And she said, I'll let you know who's in the band later. And then 3 weeks later, I got this thing that said, you're going to be in a band with Stephen King, Barbara Kingsolver, Dave Barry, Greil Marcus, all these people. And I about fell out of my chair, you know, et moi? And we went down and tried to learn how to be a rock band together. We play 50s and 60s rock and roll, and we didn't do a very good job of learning, but we had a great time. And Stephen, coming off stage, said, Redley, we're not done here. And now it's been 17 years.
Now, when you were an aspiring James Taylor, you were probably playing an acoustic guitar. How did you go from that to bass?
You know, I was, in fact, playing an acoustic guitar and a little bit of piano. And I moved out to Idaho at the end of my ruined rock and roll career. And my brother had a band out here. My brother Brad had a country western band out here, and he needed a bass player. So I picked up the bass and played in his band for a number of years, and then started one of my own out here. And it was during that period that I was recruited as a bass player for the Rock Bottom Remainders. I'm afraid I'm not a very good bass player, but I sure have a lot of fun.
My guest is the novelist Ridley Pearson. His latest novel is In Harm's Way, and he'll be in Sacramento next Monday. Finally, Ridley, in 1990, you were the first American to serve as a Raymond Chandler Fulbright Fellow in Detective Fiction at Oxford University. And more recently, you were a visiting professor at the university in Shanghai. It sounds like these are quite prestigious academic assignments. Did you seek these?
You know, the Raymond Chandler, I did. It was an offered Fulbright that some people actually here in Boise who are connected with the humanities wrote me and said, you should apply for this. It was being offered by the Fulbright Fellowship through the Raymond Chandler Estate, and they were looking for somebody to, you know, sort of connect with mystery and thriller writers in England and plan and outline a future book. So I applied and was incredibly lucky to be awarded it. It meant that I was paid to have an office at Oxford University, at Wadham College, Oxford, with a view of the Bodleian Library and the Sheldonian Theater, and think up and work on future projects. And it was just the most amazing year of my life.
Wow.
To be in this building that was built in 1055. When, you know, if you'd ever dropped a ball in my office, you couldn't find it because it went flying to another corner. There was not a square corner in this building. But I got to go all over England, and I actually went to a prison for the criminally insane, and I met regularly with the Metropolitan Police, Scotland Yard, we think of them as, and built a number of novels that I ended up writing in future years. So it was just a fabulous experience.
Well, I can imagine. Ridley Pearson, you can see him in Sacramento next Monday evening. It's August 9th at 7 o'clock at The Borders. Ridley Pearson, his latest novel is In Harm's Way. Ridley, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeffrey. It's a pleasure.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, singer-songwriter Marianne Call. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download Insight, find our archives at capradio.org/insight. Marianne Call is a Stanford-trained singer whose musical career took off in Alaska coffee shops. Along with writing and singing her songs, Marianne has also been known to play a typewriter as a musical instrument. She's now on a DIY tour of the 50 states, DIY because she's driving herself everywhere, and the tour is kind of made up on the fly, depending on where the fans ask her to go. Marianne Call plays a house concert tonight in Elk Grove. She's in her studio along with guitarist Ginger A. Thompson. Marianne, Ginger, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Marianne, tell us about going to Stanford. What did you go there to learn?
I went there to study music and completed my music major by my junior year in composition and vocal performance, and then swore I would never do anything related to music again in my entire life.
Because?
Of course. I just was done. I was interested in composing for film, and it was pretty clear by my junior year that that was not going to happen, and I wasn't really interested in any other career related to music. This was before the internet made music on the scale that it's possible now possible. So I thought it was a dead end and started looking at going into film. And then, surprise, moved to Anchorage, Alaska, and realized that neither was really viable up there.
Why did you go to Stanford? Because you were living in Washington State, weren't you?
I was. We asked the conductor of the LA Phil at that time, Grant Gershon. My parents are good friends of him from college. And they asked him, where are you getting your most interesting composers from right now? And he said, well, we're getting the most composers surely from Juilliard and other schools like that, but we're getting the smartest ones from Stanford and Harvard, even though the programs are small. So that was why I went there. That, and I was not just interested in music, but everything else as well.
And then after Stanford, you went up to Washington State and a bit because you went to Anchorage.
Yes, I moved
Why
to
Anchorage.
There was a boy involved at the time.
At the time,
yes. Yes, I was married, and we moved to Anchorage, and I looked around and went, there's nothing I can do here. I've just finished a degree at Stanford, and I'm not even eligible for entry-level administrative work. I started waiting tables, which was actually a very good thing because that was where I heard my first kind of modern, active, indie singer-songwriters. I'd never heard that before.
So as well as waiting tables in Anchorage, you started playing there, too.
Yeah, it took a couple years, but I started making my own music. I actually recorded a whole album before I ever played any music. But I knew that if these other artists could do it, then I could too.
Are you referring to the album Vanilla?
Vanilla, yes. That was my first project.
Let's listen to that song.
Ooh, when you kiss me goodnight, I wonder if you could ever mean as much to me as I do to you. I want you, but only on my terms alone.
to give you what you deserve to get. How to tell you what my heart doesn't feel just yet. Oh, how to be a good girl, how I try your mind.
The song is Vanilla by my guest Marianne Call. So you recorded that before you really got going as an artist.
Yes, it was. It's funny, and actually, that song is called Fret, but it's it's on the album Vanilla. No worries.
That's right.
No
it's worries. From Vanilla.
Yes,
there
it's
we
from
go.
Vanilla. No, okay. No, no worries. I recorded everything on that album before I had played a single live show as a sort of pop singer. I was classically trained my whole life. I'd sung lots of classical and jazz. I'd never done a single concert, and I think I might have done it differently had I been performing live before. But it's so funny to hear that now. My voice sounds so young because after performing live for a few years, it gets some miles on it.
Marianne Call plays a house concert tonight in Elk Grove. She's in her studio with guitarist Ginger A. Thompson. And you're going to do a song for us live. What is the song?
The song is called The Volvo Song. It's also off of Vanilla.
Okay. Well, let's hear it then.
All right. Here we go. Give me a B. So I'll start with you. All right. One. Oh, my darling, there is something we must discuss. How with cell phone in hand you ran my Volvo through the special bus. And I am more a Volvo than any other kind of car. Reliable and safe and Scandinavian and square. Ah, na 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 na. You've been in all the corners and you put out all the lights. So now I wanna know, baby, how you propose to make things right. Na 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 na. Oh, my darling, when you bounce that check, why didn't you think the garam fees were gonna set your sofa back? And oh, my darling sugar pie, why did you stay up all last night and put off your packing and eat too much and nearly go and miss your flight? Na 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 na. Oh, you knew you'd be miserable after that little white lie. So now why did you, 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 why? Shame on you, babe, shame on you, babe. I always don't know what you're gonna do, babe. You know what you should and should not. Maybe when you're older, baby, maybe when you're sober, then you'll stop picking zits and picking nits and picking fights. I know I'm far from perfect, baby, and I know I'm hardly good. But we'd get so much further if you would do what you should do, darling. If seeing we're caring, what a different line we'd take. If knowing we're doing, what a different world we'd make. What we want and what we need, we very, very seldom do. I want a smaller waist, I want donuts too. Ha-na-na-na-na-na-na. And we visit on each other, oh, the slings of self-defeat. And we cannot dodge the arrows of undisciplined retreat. I'd be better if my love were not so timid and controlled. I'd sleep closer if I were not both so bony and so cold.
Oh, that is tremendous. Marianne Call singing in our studio with guitarist Ginger A. Thompson. If you're interested in Marianne's house concert tonight in Elk Grove, you can get details at our website, mariannecall.com. You do something that is similar to what a lot of public radio stations do, an annual spring fundraiser. I read about it in your blog. Tell us about that.
Well, and I assist in my own NPR station's annual spring fundraiser as well. It's really where I got the idea. I have no business manager, no agent, no record label, nothing like that. I do everything myself. And every year when I come out of Alaska to tour, leaving Alaska to get to the rest of the country is quite an expensive proposition, actually. You want to have $1,000 or so on hand just to blow in case something happens, and because it just costs a tremendous amount to drive that far.
Now, what's it like, that drive, when you...
Because
go from Anchorage to any other major city must be, what, 1,000 miles?
The closest one, really, outside of Alaska. Well, Fairbanks is probably the closest, and then by road you get to Whitehorse, and nothing else really large until Edmonton. It's far. I like that drive very, very much, though. I've done it 5 times now, and I'll do it again this winter. And
you do it in the winter?
With 2 cars, caravanning for safety. But truckers do it in the winter. We can, too. It's amazing. I mean, you see things out there. You can't see anything else. I recommend that everyone drive through the Yukon one day. It's wonderful.
You tour a lot, and on your blog, you say that when you speak to people in other states, quote, "My first question is usually, why do you live here? Well, why do you live in Alaska?"
I moved there only planning to stay for a year or so and thinking there were absolutely no career opportunities for me there and just waiting until I could get out and move back to Seattle or LA or New York or somewhere. But it grew on me. It's hard to say how, but sometimes a place just resonates with you, I suppose. And Alaska did with me. The nature and the scenery and the people and the culture and the way that one person can make a big difference in the culture of the town. One business can make a big difference. One nonprofit can make a very big difference. And there's a lot of inspiring people up there. So somehow it just became home, and now I don't get to spend as much time there as I would like. But I don't know if it will be home forever, but it certainly is for the foreseeable future.
And just quickly, guitarist Ginger A. Thompson, you're touring for a while with Marianne, but just a while. Why is that? Where are you from usually?
I live in Austin, Texas, so I'll be with her until tomorrow. Actually, it's been a week that I've been traveling around with her.
So you came out to the West Coast for a week's tour?
Yes. Met her in L.A.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. And, last
Monday. So you've worked before together?
Nope. No. Like, I met her for the very first time on Monday.
Really?
And we did a show on Tuesday.
Oh, my goodness. Yep. Well, you sounded pretty familiar with that song, at least.
We played it, what, 6 times now?
I think so. Yeah, 6 times. That's about right.
Okay, well, I guess we helped you get another rehearsal in there.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, I bring in professionals, and we, you know, if they're real professionals and they can pick up the music, no problem, and we have a good time, and they get a chance to travel, all expenses paid. I can't see anything wrong with that.
And you love house concerts, don't you?
I do love house concerts. I love alternative venues. Fans contact me and say, will you please come and play in my backyard or my living room or my kitchen or in my favorite coffee shop around the corner so I don't have to walk all that far? And I say, sure. If a fan helps me set it up, I would say there are some I can't do, of course, but I hope to do in the future. But I would say that probably 90% of fans who've contacted me to set up a specific concert in a specific venue I've said yes to at this point, which is exciting. I like that. I like that model.
Marianne Call, she's a singer, songwriter, lives in Anchorage, Alaska. She's touring all 50 states. She plays a house concert tonight in Elk Grove. We can't give out the details on the air, but you can find out more information by going to mariannecall.com. That's her website, and that's Marianne, M-A-R-I-A-N. There's a link in our webpage, of course, capradio.org/insight. Marianne Call, guitarist Ginger A. Thompson, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver, Natalie Rothfels, and Sosin Morar. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Majority of residents no longer support more drilling off the coast of California, according to a new survey. On the next Insight, we'll find out why and what it means. Also, Sacramento author Brandon Novak releases the first book in a new back-to-back mystery thriller series. She'll tell you about White Heat. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.